This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. The most bizarre and disruptive presidential race in modern U.S. history is finally over. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Defying expectations of most pollsters and many in the Republican and Democratic Party establishments, former reality TV star and billionaire Donald J. Trump emerged as the 45th president of the United States. After running a divisive campaign in which he insulted a variety of demographic groups and called his Democratic adversary crooked and corrupt, Donald Trump vowed to bring the country together.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
Donald Trump on the eve of his electoral victory, adding that he pledged to be the president for all Americans. And while Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, who won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College, was the odds-on favorite to win the presidency, in the year of the outsider, she was the ultimate insider. In addition, despite predictions that she was likely to win, she admitted in her concession speech that the country was more divided than she thought.
We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power.
Democrat Hillary Clinton affirming the bedrock U.S. principle of the peaceful transfer of power as she conceded to Donald Trump. Despite her long record of public service as First Lady, as Senator, and as Secretary of State, to name just a few, Hillary Clinton was unable to shake perceptions of mistrust, which her adversary was only too happy to stoke during the campaign. In addition to being an insider in the year of the outsider, even Bernie Sanders gave her a run for her money during the primary campaign, it is usually difficult for the party in power, the Democrats, to win the equivalent of a third term. The desire for change also favored the outsider, Donald J. Trump, despite his lack of government experience. The Republicans also maintained their majorities in the Senate and House of Representatives, giving them control over all three levers of power. With us to analyze the results of the presidential and congressional elections are two distinguished political analysts. John Fortier is a political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a policy group based here in Washington. He's a regular columnist for the Politico newspaper and a regular panelist at these VOA microphones. And we're happy to welcome for the first time, and hopefully not the last, Lene Erickson-Hatalski. She's vice president for the Social Policy and Politics Program at Third Way. That's a centrist think tank based here in Washington. Both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, John Fortier, let me start with you. We've been talking about this campaign for a long time. It's finally come to a close. And it seems, John Fortier, that there are perhaps more white working class men with no college degrees than we thought, possibly women as well. How did the pollsters miss this, or was this inevitable?
Well, I think a lot of us missed this. I mean, I think the story all along, leaving aside many of the personality things that a lot of us talked about, was, is Donald Trump shooting for a slightly different coalition in the Republican Party through the primaries where he really emphasized immigration as a central issue to distinguish himself from his rivals. And then going forward, skepticism of trade into that and making a play for white working class voters. I think we all thought that he would get more of that vote, but perhaps lose some of his coalition, lose upscale suburban Republicans, women. Therefore, you know, he might not have enough to really do better than Mitt Romney or other Republicans in the past. Well, he surprised us. He's not going to win the popular vote. He may be a point or point and a half short of Hillary Clinton in votes, percentage-wise, but he did win the Electoral College by winning in states that we did not think he had a chance. States all across the Midwest, especially Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, states that have not gone for Republicans in quite a while that have a strong white working class background. And the shifts in these states were tremendous. Now, in other parts of the country, the tide went the other way. You saw California going, you know, much more strongly for Democrats, and in states like Texas, closer than you think. So the margin improved for Republicans only a few points. But the areas where Donald Trump improved by taking this message really brought him into places that we did not expect would happen and got a majority in the Electoral College in a way that many people thought was not possible.
Turning to you, Lene, for your take, particularly giving us insight on the Democrats, do you think Hillary Clinton and the campaign took too much for granted? Did she not sufficiently go after these so-called forgotten ones, as Donald Trump called them, the white working class in the Rust Belt in the Midwest? The Democrats did not perhaps understand the depth of alienation among the white working class. How do you see it?
I think that the most surprising number that I saw in the exit polls was not the support among the white working class, but rather the support among male college-educated voters. We had been seeing all along in the polling that the white working class was with Donald Trump. But when you look at least the initial exits, you see that college-educated men voted for him overwhelmingly as well. I was shocked by that because I think throughout the polling, we saw Trump was performing very differently than past Republicans with college-educated voters, that he was losing them in every single poll. And those are the folks that did something different on election day than they told the pollsters. Now, I think that Hillary Clinton's campaign did absolutely everything they could have done, but they were relying on poll numbers that just didn't pan out.
And I will add that Donald Trump also did not do as badly with minority voters as we anticipated. In fact, arguably, he did slightly better than Mitt Romney, better among African-Americans and slightly better even among Hispanics. But I think many of us assumed where he might gain in white working class votes, he would lose some there. He would lose some of the more college-educated voters. And he held those better than we thought.
And how do you explain that,
I think, Lynette? That you're totally right about the change versus the establishment feeling of the moment. And even with young people who overwhelmingly were a part of Obama's coalition and Democrats have taken for granted in the last few elections, they wanted something new. And in focus groups, when we were talking to young people, they would say, well, Obama's just done the regular stuff. And so Hillary's just more of that. We want something new and exciting. That, in part, is due to just having a third term of a Democratic president. And I'm not sure there's anything else she could have done about that. But if you are a younger person, I'm a millennial, but if you're even on the younger side of millennials, that sees Barack Obama's presidency as basically the regular thing that we should all be used to and don't remember anything but him, Hillary doesn't seem like very much of a change.
Even though she would have been the first female president.
I think that a lot of younger people never thought that they weren't going to be able to be president as a woman. So there was certainly kind of surge around the end with folks who were really, really excited about that prospect. But when I talked to women voters and when I was even at the convention, the women that were the most taken by the firstness of that were an older generation.
And no question, John Fortier, notwithstanding her many qualities, Hillary Clinton had many negatives. And those were stoked by Donald Trump. Therefore, I would like to ask you if you think there were maybe other factors at play in catapulting Donald Trump to this highest elective office. Do you think, for example, that the Russian espionage, the fact that the Russians hacked into the DNC, leaked emails to WikiLeaks, which then made them public, there was embarrassing information about Hillary Clinton, about the workings of the DNC favoring Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. There was the letter by FBI Director Comey warning the Congress just 10 days before the election that there were some other emails that they found that might be relevant, but he didn't say if they were, and then only coming out 3 days before the election saying that there was nothing there, that this might have turned the tide, even if marginally, for Hillary Clinton.
There was a lot of negativity to go around. I mean, just from the beginning, these were two candidates who had high negatives. And partly in Hillary Clinton's case, it was she's been on the national stage for a long time. I actually think, you know, she was in a reasonably good position because while, yes, people had seen her and she was not going to have the highest ceiling in the world, she also had a good base. But starting with those numbers, both candidates, you know, ran a tough campaign and all of these things came out. You mentioned the list, certainly on Donald Trump's side, many of them self-inflicted. There were all sorts of negative stories as well, too. So I don't know how we separate out all of the negativity that was going on in the fall here. But in an interesting way, Hillary Clinton had a strength, but it was also partly a weakness. And it was that Hillary Clinton, the only figure in the Democratic Party really who had her foot in one part of the Democratic Party, sort of an older part, and in the more modern Democratic Party. She's still associated with her husband, Bill Clinton, who moved the party back to the center, but had moved to be, you know, a lot like Barack Obama, a somewhat more progressive figure. And then, of course, had Bernie Sanders and others pulling her maybe even further to the left. I thought going into this that was ultimately a strength because she could seem to be a more centrist candidate. But the flip side of that was she was a establishment candidate and one that the progressives weren't as excited about and a lot of people weren't as excited, even though she had a lot of qualities that were good for governing.
Also, the WikiLeaks piece in particular played into a downside that Hillary has had since the beginning, which is that people feel that she is calculated, that she's not speaking from her heart. And so if you have emails that are then showing all the back and forth that goes on in every campaign about how to say something, whether to say it, how do we frame this, then keep reinforcing this notion that she doesn't really have a core, that she's just following the polls or what consultants tell her to do, that reinforces something people already believed. And I think it was very clear in a lot of the research that we've done with some of the voters that were leaning more towards Trump that they liked he said what he thought. So the things that were coming out about him showed that he did say what he thought. Now, I find the things that he said repulsive, so I would not have voted for him, but no one could have said that he was being calculated about what he said. So I think the kind of authenticity of he says what he thought appealed to a lot of people.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Lene Erickson-Hatalski, from whom you just heard, vice president for the Social Policy and Politics Program at Third Way. We're discussing the outcome and implications of the U.S. presidential election, which resulted in a Republican sweep of the White House and both chambers of Congress. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to Wilfred Segundare, who wakes up at 3 a.m. to listen to The Voice of America in Lokoja in Kogi State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're back to you, John Fortier, to talk about some of Donald Trump's shortcomings and how he was able to somehow overcome them and win the presidency. It's hard to really make a list of the things he said, the derogatory comments vis-a-vis women, vis-a-vis the disabled, excoriating the press for not being honest. At the same time, he benefited highly from press coverage. One could even say the press wasn't responsible enough in holding him to account. So given all these remarks, are we to just think that they were just words on paper? We note that he met this week with President Obama to discuss the transition. President Obama characterized the talks as excellent and wide-ranging. Are bygones going to be bygones? I mean, how do you see going forward the tone of this transition?
Well, you're right. I mean, I think at various times in the campaign, almost too many to count, we thought he had stepped over a line that candidates don't go over and that it would be the end of him. And the one I think that was perhaps the most recent and one of the most egregious was 3 weeks ago when tapes came out about his comments on women, where it looked like his campaign might just completely implode and go down. And he did recover from that, I think a variety of things, some of the focus of some of the negatives on Hillary Clinton, some ways in which he pulled himself back in. But here he is. I guess I would say this, that one thing in this election we noted was that the average Republican voter, they may have had some reservations about him, but they were with Donald Trump. He won Republicans by large margins, comparable or even better than other Republicans. But the establishment Republicans are still very divided. Many of them have said they wouldn't support him, been on the other side, been never Trump people. And that coming together, I think, is what Donald Trump is going to have to figure out. Sure, he's also, I guess I think he probably is going to say some controversial things in the future. That's partly who he is. But for the short term, trying to mend some fences with Paul Ryan, with other leaders in Washington, because ultimately, you know, right now, I think all the Republicans find themselves in a position they were not expecting, and that they have these majorities. And while Donald Trump ran a different kind of campaign on some different issues, there's still a fair number of things that all these Republicans believe in common and arguably could work together if there were, you know, some sense that they would do that. And we will see. Donald Trump is such an outsider, such a different figure that we don't know how he will play. But I think that's the more positive side, that Republicans are trying to look to see, can they find common ground and use those majorities to move some things that they both agree on?
We'll talk about that in just a minute with you. But first, let me turn back to Lene to talk about how the Democrats are seeing the election of Donald Trump after so many words were spoken, derogatory comments toward many in the Democratic coalition, whether women, whether minorities, denigration of immigrants, Latinos. It's hard to go through all of them. In the press, he used the word Lügenpresse, lying press. This harks back to the Nazi era, his rapprochement with the so-called alt-right, very scary right-wing groups. We see them on the rise in Europe. There's a concern among these groups as we speak. They're afraid to go out of their homes, Muslims, women with headscarves. How will he be able to bring America together, as he pledged to do on the eve of his election?
I think that's a very difficult question. Most of the Democrats that I know right now are in a state of grief and fear about what happens next, especially people that are in some of those groups that were denigrated, people that have disabilities or people with family members that have disabilities. I am an LGBT person, very concerned about whether he's going to mean what he said in the campaign. But I think he needs to realize that his words mean something now. And that he's not allowed to just say whatever he wants because he will have the bully pulpit. And that's a terrifying thing based on what he said in the past. I hope that he can move forward and, you know, have at least the self-control to not repeat those things in the future, now knowing the power that his words have. But I'm very worried about it. And I do think that the fact that so many mainstream Republicans, establishment Republicans, were willing to vote for him, even though he said all of these things, just shows how tribal our politics have become. There are so many people who said, this person does not speak for me. Religious conservatives, evangelicals, who said, this is not the kind of role model that I want for my kids. And yet they voted for him across the board. So there's something there that we're going to have to figure out as a country going forward.
Well, back to you, John Fortier, because I think we can't really underestimate these slogans, take our country back, lock her up, with reference to Hillary Clinton. We heard recently Rudy Giuliani, one of his supporters, who may be in the running for a cabinet position, saying that he may consider, or that the administration might consider, prosecuting Hillary Clinton. He used the term Second Amendment solutions, empowering the gun right lobbies. There's anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, you know, we don't know to what extent he really means all of this, and it will somehow play out in policies and tone. To what extent do you think the so-called establishment Republicans are willing to face him on these? And then there are the other issues on which there are severe differences. International trade, free trade. This has been a hallmark of Republicans. And of course, President Obama even embraced free trade, the TPP, NAFTA, seeing Russia as a true adversary, which it is. It's a major threat, as stated by all of our intelligence agencies. They grabbed Crimea in the most unbelievable challenge to the post-World War II order. There are so many issues on which he is in disagreement, at least on the face of it, with mainstream Republicans.
Well, look, I think that you're right. There are a lot of worries that Donald Trump will say and continue to do some of the things he has on the campaign trail. The Republicans who want him to succeed and have wanted since the convention, even those who didn't support him, have hoped, and this has only partially come true, that some ways by bringing him more into the establishment, giving him more advisors, normalizing him, that some of this will actually calm down or be channeled in a certain way. And I think you've seen, again, in some areas where Donald Trump is more conventional, looks more like a typical Republican. In other areas, he's not. So I think we're not going to be able to resolve this, absolutely. As we go into government, some more of that can happen. But of course, there are also other challenges in terms of staffing an administration. This is a big job with thousands of people. And while we're floating names for the cabinet now, those are only the top positions. And so trying to sort of get a government of people who many Republican types in Washington who would take a jobs administration are not necessarily on his team. So I think there are a lot of challenges. But I think I would stress that there are also some incentives to work together on issues that they can work on. And I think legislatively, there are some things that they will do, whether everyone likes them or not. I think the sort of border security issues, which Donald Trump will say is the wall, but other things, the Republicans would agree on that. They agree on thinking about a new health care plan. Now, that's difficult to do, but certainly they agree that that's the direction they want to go on. I think you might find them doing some things in the infrastructure and tax realm, which they kind of agree on. So, you know, there's a lot of things to do, and probably a best case scenario for Republicans is that they focus on some of the things they do agree on. And of course, there will be some strong disagreements on some of the other things along the way.
because Paul Ryan, the current Speaker of the House, said that Donald Trump has a mandate now. So we need to know, what does that mean? He's talked about repealing Obamacare. There's a Supreme Court that could potentially reverse many advances that many see have occurred over the past decade.
Those are things that Republicans probably would agree on and Democrats would oppose. There are other things that would be wedges within the Republican coalition, you know, and those I actually think probably the Republicans will find common ground, that they want a similar kind of nominee to the Supreme Court and that they want to at least say they've gotten rid of Obamacare and come up with an alternative. I think those are things that they can agree on.
Well, Lene, let me turn to you and ask you how the Democrats are planning to regroup in the face of these major challenges, challenges to what many Democrats would say are advances over the past decade. Of course, we have the Supreme Court now, which was probably an issue on which some people voted for Mr. Trump, wanting a more conservative court. Are people really concerned among the Democrats that rulings like Roe v. Wade may be overturned? And how will the Democrats govern as a minority?
I think the Democrats are very united right now. It was clear on the campaign trail that Donald Trump was kind of making all of us bind together and agree on what we at least didn't want to see happen in our country. And so I think, you know, you'll see a lot of Democrats uniting around protecting President Obama's legacy. I think the immediate concern is the dismantling of the health care that so many people have gotten under the ACA. And then what happens to the Supreme Court, not just with this first appointment, but with potentially another and a third, which most presidents, even with a single term, have had two or three appointments. And you can replace a Scalia with a Scalia, but if you replace Justice Ginsburg with one, then we are going to see a lot of people in this country have rights taken away that they rely upon. So I think there's a huge amount of concern about immigration and what happens with the executive orders on immigration that President Obama has given. I mean, it is a fundamental value of this country that children should not be punished for their parents' sins. And he has said he is going to take away the legal status that the Dreamers have and maybe give that 700,000 person list to his deportation force.
And as we close, John Fortier, let's look at the U.S. role in the world. President-elect Trump has signaled to our allies some serious doubts, saying that NATO is potentially obsolete. He disagrees with some in his own party how to characterize Russia, which is a major adversary, which is guilty of having interfered in the U.S. election. He has given, one could say, comfort to adversaries like Putin's Russia, the right-wing parties in France and Germany, Hungary. How are we going to reconcile this? Do you have any sense as to who he might appoint in his cabinet?
Well, look, I'm not sure this is going to make everybody feel better, but in an interesting way, Donald Trump, we know the least about what he will do in foreign policy. He has some directions and comments that I think worry people, but in terms of his advisors, they've been the least connected to typical Republican advisors of any part of his campaign. And he doesn't have experience in this area. And it was a big contrast with Hillary Clinton. I think some would say the comments that he made about Putin are more about, you know, leadership and things like this in a kind of offhand way. And where he's going to go with Russia policy may be different, but I think it's a big wild card. Have there been some names floated for Secretary of State, people from Newt Gingrich, who's close to him, to Bob Corker, who's senator and the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee? Those are all possibilities. I do think as he builds an advisory team and puts people in place, that I think gives some more structure to what he's going to do and is going to force him to make some decisions, which I think at this point he hasn't made formal decisions in this area. So it's a bigger wild card.
Lene Erickson-Hatalski, the last word to you on the U.S. role in the world under a potential Trump administration.
I think it's clear that President Trump will be the least qualified commander-in-chief we've had perhaps ever. And I just hope that there will be people who will go to work in the State Department, in the Defense Department, that do understand the complicated dynamics in the world that we face and will help him have a nuanced approach, which I don't think has been, you know, his take so far about some of the things that we're going to face as a country together. And I'm hopeful that there are enough Republicans who are common sense, who understand history and where our country needs to show leadership, that they will pull him back from the brink.
On that dubious note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, John Fortier. He's political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And Lene Erickson-Hatalski. She's vice president for the Social Policy and Politics Program at Third Way. Thanks so much for your wonderful insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.